know more about that as well. Sorry, I can't. And she will speak to you for a few minutes, and then we'll open up the questions.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. As she said, I am a single adoptive parent. I have two kids. I found out very quickly when I first tried to adopt 4 years ago. As a single person, it's very difficult to be and elected as a result to adopt my children overseas. So my children are both from Guatemala, and they are both considered special needs children because of their physical disabilities that they had. And my daughter's case, she's improving greatly. My son has some permanent disabilities, but he's also the star of the soccer team, and I'm very proud of him. So that's my personal interest. In addition, I have two adopted sisters and adopted nephew and so on and so forth. So it's a big deal in our family. We're very proud of it. I thought we'd start out today by just giving you a few adoption statistics that aren't in the folder here. Now, some of you are much more expert in adoption than I am. Joe Cole and Jeff Rosenberg are both with the National Adoption Organization. So you can correct me if I'm going to get here. Well, who knows? Okay, first of all, there are about 140,000 children adopted each year in the United States. About 50,000 of those are stranger or unrelated adoptions. The rest are primarily and have to do with custody. There are about 36,000 children available for adoption right now. About 60% of those children are special needs, and we refer to special needs as defined differently in different states, but generally it means children who are older, who are a part of who are sibling groups, brothers and sisters who want to be adopted together. In many cases, it may mean minority children. It may mean children who, it does mean children who have physical or emotional handicaps, mental handicaps, kids who are not always easy to place. We have about 276,000 children in foster care at any given time in the United States. That the length of stay varies dramatically. It may be a few days, it may be 6 months, it may be under a year. But we have found that over 40% remain in foster care for more than 2 years. 2 years is a long period of time in a child's life. We've noticed a dramatic increase in foreign adoption in the last several years. For FY86. There were 10,000 foreign adoptions. Many of those children come from Korea and Latin America and India. In terms of adoption trends and how adoption has changed in the last, I'd say, 10 or 15 years, the number of babies available here in the United States is limited. Part of the reason for that is that abortion has become more popular. We have found that there are millions of teen pregnancies per year. Over 50% of those, about 40% of those result in abortion, 10% in miscarriages and other physical problems that result in the end of the pregnancy, and the remainder, about 50%, are live birth. And we found that the overwhelming majority of those live births do not go to adoption, but the teen mothers decide to keep those children. So that's a pretty good statistic. We have seen more attention, we've seen an increased foreign adoption, we've seen more attention given to special needs children, and permanency plan. In 1980, the government passed a federal law that was landmark legislation that said for the very first time that foster care public agencies must have permanency plans for these children. They must have case reviews after a certain period of time a child enters foster care. I think the first case review is 6 months. There must be a hearing to decide the fate of the child within 18 months and so on, so that there is some movement to move the child through foster care and into a plan for adoption or into a plan to return the child to the natural parent. There is a slow, very slow expansion of non-traditional adoptive parents that we're starting to see now. single adoptive parent, parent to who are older or who may have handicaps, but it's very slow, and this is something we're very interested in working on. In terms of the task force, we were formed, as you'll notice in your announcement, on August 24th because of the president's ongoing interest in the strength of the family. The president is an adoptive parent. The vice president is an adoptive grandparent. He's very proud, and you have to listen to my stories about his adoption. Just as you have to listen to my stories about mine. So there's a tremendous personal as well as a professional interest in moving children into clinics for adoption and moving them into permanent loving homes. The task force was composed, or is composed, of 13 high-ranking government officials. And in the past several months, we have been in contact with over 130 groups that represent adoptees, adoptive parents, birth parents, which are judges, lawyers, the American Bar Association, the Child Welfare League, child welfare professionals, caseworkers, individual caseworkers, and so on, so that we had a good, I think, a good basis on which to make some determination. We were asked to review federal law and regulation, federal tax policy, look at some innovative state laws, and identify barriers to adoption and ways to promote adoption. One example that we used in terms of promoting adoption, that was something we did very quickly and very successfully, was to, with the president's lead, contact all the federal agencies in our government, which represents over 3 million people, and ask them to conduct adoption information fairs and other activities during National Adoption Week. This was something that we started at my agency, OPM, last year. We have about 2,300 employees. And as a result of 3 days' work at lunchtime, and lunchtime only at our headquarters, we were able to place in adoption 6 special needs children, and that's something we're very proud of. And this was one recommendation we had for the president, which he followed up on this year, and we have a number of families I know of at OPM, I don't know the tally at this point for the other federal agencies, who are in the process of adopting as a result of that 3 day information at lunchtime. So it works, and you get to know the job, it does work. Some of the areas that we covered when we did our study, one thing we were interested in was infant adoption. One concern of ours was crisis pregnancy counseling. When a woman has a crisis pregnancy and she's interested in the possibility of, she wants to know what are her options, what can she do? We have found in the past that sometimes adoption is just not discussed as a viable option. Now, there are many reasons for that. We have found in some cases where a woman, we have documented cases where a woman may pursue adoption as the alternative for her crisis pregnancy and be told that because she is a minority woman and her child will be Black or Hispanic or indeterminate, that child may not be adopted and therefore she should pursue other options. Now, that's the kind of thing we want to change. We want people to know whether they're teenagers or they're older women who have a crisis pregnancy, that adoption works. It's a very loving option and it's something they want to consider. We have found with teenagers that in high school, the concept of giving your child away to strangers, which is the way adoption is interpreted, is a very negative concept and something they do not want to do because they love their babies. And we want adoption to have a positive identification. So one of the things we are taking a look at is some curriculum ideas to discuss adoption in our schools. I know when my sisters were adopted in the past, that my family was very proud of the fact that they were adopted, but it was not considered something to be discussed in the community, whether it was in the school or anywhere else. It was very hush-hush. And while you may elect not to discuss something that we want to discuss in the schools in general so that people know this is one way of family building. It works for birth parents. It works for the adoptees. It works for the adoptive parents. It's a win-win situation, as the sports people say. One thing we took a look at was the birth father's interest in a crisis pregnancy. We he found that over 40 states require some type of public notification, you know, if a woman decides when she's in crisis pregnancy, to opt for abortion, that's her private decision. That's not something that requires anyone else's input. If she decides to adopt, many states require that she have some type of notification for the birth father. It may be that she does not have a long-standing relationship with that man and doesn't want him involved in this process, but nonetheless, there is that requirement. And in some instances, we have found that it must be a public notification. Mary Brown is going to have a baby in 6 months. Anyone who may be not. Now, as you can imagine, that tends to dissuade women from electing adoption as something they'd be interested in. So we have taken a look at a program that New York State has that has been supported by the courts, which says that if the father is identified, the father needs a notification. If the father is not identified by the birth mother, then a postal registration, very simply sending in a postcard saying, I have an interest in this child's future, and I want to know about any custody situation or any adoption situation, is a good way to balance the birth father's rights and at the same time allow that child to be moved forward to adoption. So that's something we're very interested in. In terms of maternity home care for adoption, we have found that the number of maternity homes has dropped significantly, starting to move back up again. Maternity homes today are not what we may remember from years and years ago, where some young girl was sent off to supposedly visit Aunt Matilda for 9 months. And in reality, was sent to some institution, you know, some dark, forbidden institution. Maternity homes today are very helpful to young women who have a crisis pregnancy. They will provide vocational counseling. They will provide educational help to continue on with their high school diploma or whatever. They will offer parenting classes in case the young woman decides to keep her baby. So it's a very positive thing to take her away from peer pressure, maybe family difficulties or whatever, and offer her a good place to get the medical help, the educational help she needs, and to make her decision. So the state of California has a very catchy title for its law, the Pregnancy Freedom of Choice, I think. And the rationale behind that is that the state of California feels that because it funds abortions, that it should also fund alternatives to abortion, such as maternity homes. So it does provide funding for licensed maternity homes. We also took a look at children in foster care. And we have found some encouraging things and some very discouraging things. Let me say at the outset that much of foster care in a family home is very welcome and a very beautiful experience for the children after they've been through some really tough times. Having said that, we believe that in many instances, children spend too long a period of time in foster care. We have found, for example, in the state of Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, children spend over 5 years in foster care before they move to a clinic for adoption and actually find a home. In the city of Baltimore, it's over 7 years. Yes, an average. That's right. And we think that's too long a period of time for children to spend in a foster care situation. That's not always the case. I mean, there may be circumstances where that is a necessary situation, but we have found that there are lots of problems involved with that. For example, the state of New Jersey just conducted a study with the ADA to identify problems with the court procedures and the petitions for the termination of parental rights. Now, obviously, the president, the administration, our task force believes whenever possible, we want to see these children reunited with their birth families. There's no question about that. But sometimes it just isn't going to work. And the caseworkers have to know when enough is enough. When do you decide that you've made all these efforts to try and reunite the family or to move the children into a home with relatives? When is enough enough? And when do you make that pivotal decision to petition to terminate parental rights? It's a tough question. But it's something that has to be decided at some point so these children aren't lost in foster care drift, as we call it. So we have discussed and reviewed the new innovative approaches to procedures to file for termination recommendations as far as that was concerned. In terms of administrative costs for foster care, we have found that administrative costs in the last 5 years have increased 438%. The amount of money that the federal government puts into this particular program has increased 438%. The number of children that receive this money has increased about 5%. There are many reasons for that. I'm sure it's not a simple thing. Administrative costs aren't what you normally think of as administrative costs. They're not clerk typists and they're not machines and desks and so on. It's an expanded description of administrative costs, but nonetheless, it's something that we want to take a look at and see how the money is being used and is it being used to move these children through the system and into a plan for adoption when that is appropriate. So, in terms of state innovations and private innovations that we have seen in Kentucky, I think there's someone here from Kentucky. I think that's a newspaper today, isn't it? Oh, goodness. And I read up on Kentucky. Gosh, I really blew that one. Okay, well, I should have done a survey of other states. Anyway, Kentucky has some very interesting approaches to a number of problems in terms of post-adoption services. For one thing, you know, a lot of our kids are special needs kids. Their problems don't stop the day they're adopted and walk in the door to that family. Those problems continue on, and the family has to make adjustments as well. So we are very interested in post-adoption services, and this is something we're going to be following up on with our experts here and some other folks to see what might be workable in the various states. Kentucky, through funding by the federal government, has coordinated a plan for for education officials, for child welfare officials, and for mental health officials to coordinate efforts to provide special post-adoption services. Some of the kids are pretty hard to place, and it's a difficult thing to say, but not every child may be someone who can move into an adoptive home. We have really tough problems. We know one case in particular of a 10-year-old, a beautiful 10-year-old boy who does very well at school, but he's been a victim of repeated child abuse and sex abuse. He's been in foster care for 2 years, and he's had 14 years of foster care placements and one disruptive adoption. Now, that's an extreme case, but that shows you the type of situation that we sometimes face. We heard many frustrating problems from people that we talked to across the country. One judge, for example, in St. Louis told us of a case. It was an extreme case, but it was the point across, where she had a young girl, 4 years old, whose father was a drug dealer and a wife dealer, and eventually he killed the wife and the child as a result because the father had to go to prison. The child was put into foster care. She was in foster care for 3 years when the maternal grandmother decided to adopt her and give her a permanent home. The father had been notified repeatedly by the social service agency over a period of 3 years that he must make some contact with the child. He must show some interest, even if it's just a birthday card or a Christmas card. He must make some contact and preferably make some plans for her future. He did nothing for the 3 years. When he found out that the judge had approved this petition for terminating the parental rights and to allow the grandmother to adopt, he filed an appeal. And the appeals court said that they were going to reverse that decision because the father couldn't help the fact that he was in prison for 30 years. And so they were going to deny the grandmother access to the child, deny the child the home she was to remain in foster care permanently, and she was to have mandatory visits with her father in prison, X number of times per year. We had some really tough cases in the district recently, which you've probably read about in the papers. Mother and father, drug addicts, homeless, in shelters, bouncing from shelter to shelter. They had 2 children, 4 and 6, who both had cerebral palsy, needed wheelchairs. the mother abandoned the family. The father just couldn't cope with it anymore, and the social services people in the district tried repeatedly to have the children removed from the home. Not even to the point where there would be a termination of parental rights, but just to remove them from the home and put them into foster care because they feared for the children's lives. They were turned down three different occasions by the judge, and the father one day just couldn't deal with it anymore and instead the two children's death. Now, again, that's an extreme case, but we see these repeated across the country. We have seen children who have been put in jail because the caseworkers who decide that they don't want those children placed, whether in a transracial foster care situation or some other type of problem, and we've seen children actually put in jail and only released when the sheriff was threatened with arrest for violating their constitutional rights by placing them in prison, in jail. We have seen the foster care situation with the border babies in New York City. You may have read about that. Children who, babies who are growing up in Huntsville because the caseworkers and the agencies cannot find foster care that they feel is appropriate in the immediate area, when private agencies have repeatedly offered to place these children in the greater New York area rather than in the immediate city, or further away, whether it's in a transracial home or whatever. But the point is, these children are 2 and 3 and 4 years old growing up in the hospital. Now, as they get older and they're in their crib and they start to get up and try to walk, wire mesh is put on top of the crib so that they can't get out and run around and fall and maybe hurt themselves. We've heard stories, and we've been able to document some of them, of children who have slept on caseworkers' desks at night. So this is a situation that the girl I want to talk about. You know, I started to tell my mother this, and she said, "But that's not America." And I said, "Yeah, it is America." So this is a tough situation we're trying to come up with. We just scratched the surface in some of these problems we've seen with foster care. We want to find these children. We want to maintain the system and get them placed in a permanent loving home, whether that's back with their natural families and help whatever it takes to get them back there so that the family works together again, or to find them those loving homes through adoption. So, we've taken a look at some innovative ways that the states have approached it. For example, Michigan has contracting out. The state agency, when it has special needs children, kids who are tough to place, notifies private agencies that here are these children, you know, please offer us a plan for adoption, recruitment of a family, and actual placement of the child. And we will reimburse you for the costs associated with that up to $10,000. That seems to be working quite successfully because the private agencies are located in communities where they know how to tap those resources. And their costs are recovered. You know, the agencies have a tough time paying all the expenses associated with these adoptions because when you try to recruit, that's a very expensive procedure. So their costs will be reimbursed. We've seen some private programs that have worked very successfully. I don't know if you saw that movie recently about Father Clemens in Illinois. But Father Clemens adopted a number of children. And he started a program called One Church, One Child. And he has gone around to a number of churches and asked them if they would be responsible for placing one child in their church community. And it has worked very successfully in Illinois. There have been some problems in trying to start it across some other states. But at least that's one thing that we know works in the state of Illinois. I could go on forever talking about this issue. Obviously, you can tell that it's my favorite issue, and I love it very dearly, and I have a personal commitment to it. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have. Yeah. Well, this is not something that is a matter of state law or federal law. This is agency policy for the most part. It's slowly changing very slowly. And for the first time, you know, when I talked to the people here at the White House and they first asked me to do this, I said, you have to understand single parent, adoptive parent cited from the White House as good sources, you know, for adopting these children. There are a number of single parent groups that are starting to form together. There are very few statistics about who are these people who aren't married and why do they want to adopt. How strange, you know? You know, to find out just who these people are, you know, what's their general income, what kind of work do they do, what kind of time do they have to commit to their children, you know, and how does that work? We found that certainly a lot of agencies are now using some form of open adoption, where if you're talking about infant adoption, the birth mother has some degree of involvement in the decision-making process as to which set or individual prospective parent should go to, you know, should be the parent of parents for her child. And very often we have found that these young women don't want to opt for a single parent, which I have no quarrel with. I understand that, you know. And if I were in that particular situation, I'd probably feel the same way. So with the long waiting list that agencies have for people who want to adopt, you know, it's understandable that they would automatically view a two-parent family as more acceptable for a child, better deal for the kid. In my own situation, I was very interested in adopting a child with disabilities because I have over 20 years experience in working with handicapped children, not as a job, but as a volunteer basis, and with kids in my family who had disabilities. And I couldn't even get past the phone call with a lot of agencies here in the area here. I couldn't schedule an interview. And I said, but wait, I know how to work with these kids. You know, you wouldn't believe the kinds of stuff you can do with these kids. You know, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And now that is slowly changing as those of us who are single parents start to talk more, and as those of you start writing articles about successful single parent families. It's starting to change slowly, but if that's the way it has to be done, unfortunately, you know, you don't want to pass some law saying all single people must be able to, you know, that's not the way to do it. But as the public sees more how our children thrive, you know, and the love they have, and how we make special efforts to work with them, you know, I think that's making some change.
So I don't understand that.
Sure. They were recommendations. When I had the final report for publication purposes out at the end of March. Those are quick summaries of recommendations. That's not our full-fledged report. That's just to give you a flavor of the kind of thing we discussed.
So did the president approve the recommendation?
Yes, he did. That's right. The next step is this. We've made all these great sounding recommendations, and now we have to put our money where our mouth is. You know, we have to hammer them through. We are following up on a number of fronts. We're interested in getting more corporate and private sector company support for innovative adoption ideas for promoting adoption. Some things are very simple. A company newsletter could once a month carry a picture, or once every 3 months, carry a picture of a child who is actually available for adoption. Some newspapers, some television shows do this across the country. It's usually referred to as Wednesday's Child or Friday's Child or whatever day of the week is appropriate. And it's very successful. Very successful. It works. The television shows work. You know, if any of you are interested in putting a picture of the child, certainly, you know, we have a number of people here who could help you with that. And it works. If you run positive adoption stories in your publications, that works. You know, we always, whenever I work with someone and have a story done, I always ask that they put a box in. And it says, you know, if you're interested in adopting, you know, call this, this, this. I usually get the phone calls. They're usually at 11 o'clock at night. But that's okay. I welcome them anyway, you know, to help someone adopt. So we're continuing to work on them. And we're also interested in post-adoption services. So that's one project we're going to follow.
Is there a deadline on the follow-up?
No, we're just plugging along here. And, well,
system be set up, and apparently the states who were involved in the discussions bought into it on the assumption or the promise that the federal government would support the funding of the establishment of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's obviously a fiscal question. I know you make a reference to it in your recommendation.
Right.
The way you deal with the fiscal question is there's going to be a price tag there that's in the price tag.
There's going to be a price tag, you're talking about the clearinghouse, the National Adoption Clearinghouse, rather than the telecommunications network.
I'm talking about the data collection.
Right.
All the
right.
States have the same
right.
system.
Right. Well, this is something that, you know, that we've gotten a commitment for now, and what we do in the future, you know, is the kind of consumption system, you know, and where we go from there, and what the auction is going on. But certainly those of us who are interested in it, your organization, Jeff's, and those of us who are adopted parents will keep pounding on that and see where we can go. But the money is there for now. You know, we'll just have to see what administration comes in and see if they have the kind of support for adoption that we have, and we hope that increase that kind of, you know, attention to it.
The other question I had is in terms of public 1967,
mm-hmm.
facts that you quoted in relationship to Maryland, which are appalling at best. The federal government really hasn't stepped in with any kind of monitoring there, where they do have,
they
have some rights to do that.
Yeah.
Is there any
they do monitor, but as you know,
you know,
96272 is the federal law that the Adoption Assistance and Child Welfare Act, and this is the law I was making reference to, which is permanency planning for children, where you have specific, you know, if the state accepts foster care funding from the federal government, there's a corollary that has to go along with it. You have to have a 6-month case review. You have to have the 18-month hearing, and so on. This is something that we want to take a look at in depth, and this is one of the projects we're going to be following up on to see what other recommendations we can include. The Maryland figures have come because the state of Maryland, the governor requested a task force, and the task force spent a year studying their system and why it doesn't work. And we are taking a look at that particular thing to see if it's appropriate to put more teeth in it. In terms of reviewing it, we do review about unfortunately, about 1-2% of the foster care projects that come through there to make sure that they are the timely procedures. Obviously, that isn't enough, but when you're dealing with 50 states and the number of children we're talking about, that's a tremendous responsibility. One of the things we talked about in our recommendation was foster care review boards, either at the county or at the state level. These are made up of private citizens who work in concert with the adoption agencies to make sure that these children are taken care of as best the best way possible, and that they're constantly in front of the process. A study was done, I believe, in Nebraska, where they took a look at children who were in the foster care review board system, and another group of children with similar characteristics who were not in the system. The children who were in the system and had this foster care review board sort of peeking over the shoulders of these agency people, those children were placed twice as fast and zipped through the process twice as fast as the other children. So it helps to have these foster care review boards. I think about 9 states have them now in some form. In addition to that, there are some other innovative approaches with court advocates for children who work with the attorneys and the parents and the agencies to represent the interests of children in the courtroom. And this is something that the National Juvenile and Family Court Judges is really an organization, which is 2,500 judges across the country. They're very interested in this project and promoting it across the state as another form of moving these children through expeditiously and with their interests. That's the primary consideration. No, we didn't, because we were focusing on agency adoption. Private adoption, you know, there are laws in every state to deal with private adoption, you know, whether it's permissible, what types of restrictions on intermediaries, you know, people who work between the doctor parent.
Yeah.
Well, lawyers and doctors.
Doctors.
You know, and nurses in the hospitals and so on. And we have found that as problems arise, for example, in the Pennsylvania case recently, where some man was taking out young pregnant girls and moving them down to Louisiana because Louisiana had lax laws related to this, that the system seems to correct itself with great speed. And Louisiana, needless to say, because of the problems associated with it, zipped some legislation right through and made the appropriate correction. So this is not something we really address. We're more concerned about the agency situation. And again, we looked only at stranger or unrelated adoption. We did not look at custody adoption because that wasn't something we were concerned about.
Who's
been
in the
Well, one of the things we were asked to do by the president was review current congressional legislation to see whether or not there was legislation needed, further legislation needed. One of the things we noted in looking at federal law was that there is a discrimination against adopted children that does exist in Social Security, disability, and retirement benefits. If you become disabled or retired and have a birth child either prior to that retirement or disability or after that retirement or disability, that child is automatically covered. If you adopt a child prior to your disability or retirement, the child is covered. If you adopt after that period, the child is not covered. So this is something we're anxious to correct. Congressman McEwen has legislation to correct now. That's something, by the way, that the Paralyzed Veterans of America and a number of other veterans groups are very interested in pursuing. Along with our concept of supporting people who have disabilities as good potential parents. A number of veterans groups are interested in that. And so this was one piece of legislation that we really have backed. We talked to OMB and the Social Security Administration. Commissioner Hardy, the head of Social Security, is the former Assistant Secretary for Human Development Services and a big supporter of special needs adoption. And so we had absolutely no problem at all dealing with her. And she's on board. Everyone in the administration is on board to push that legislation through. In terms of any legislative changes that may need to come in the future, as I said, we are reviewing PL 96272, the adoption assistance, to see what, if anything, needs to be done there to give it more teeth or greater review, as Joe says, or whatever. We are also taking a look at the foster care funding, administrative cost funding situation, and a number of other things with the idea that, you know, if it's necessary. These are the kinds of questions you don't want to try and make a pop answer in 2 months' period of time. These are very difficult things to work with. You want to assure that the child's welfare is the primary consideration, but you also want to assure the appropriate rights of the state and the appropriate decisions that should be made by the private and public agencies. And we don't want to come in heavy-handed and dictate to them, but we want to make sure that the rights of the children are taken care of. That's our first consideration. So, anybody else have anything?
Well, you mentioned the adoption fairs.
Yes.
You mentioned it in a two-day period. I just wondered what sorts of things do you tell people? Are you finding that a lot of people never thought about adoption fairs because they never knew that much about it?
Or we have found a number of, first of all, people have some preconceived notions about adoption. And sometimes we find that this is they're right, this is the case with some individual agencies. People who are not professionals in their careers feel that they cannot adopt because of their income level. People who are single, people with handicaps, people who are older. Now, we have found, I cannot tell you the number of letters we've gotten from people who say, well, you know, I'm 40 years old and I want to adopt and I've been told I'm too old. We had one letter from a woman who was 35, her husband is 52. She was told by all these agencies because her husband was 52 she could not adopt. One caseworker suggested she get a divorce, try to adopt as a single person, and then marry her husband again. And then this was told her seriously. So these are the kinds of situations we run across periodically. But in terms of the adoption fairs, people don't know what kinds of kids are available. When people think about adopting, they think about babies. That's natural. They think that, and they hear there aren't any babies available. So they automatically dismiss that. But you know, you'll find that if you have pictures of kids and explain their situation, also explain that there may be medical assistance available to help take care of that. Or, you know, this is how you deal with this particular problem. You know, if you have a child with Down syndrome, that doesn't mean that child is shoved into an institution automatically. That child can do well, you know, with the proper therapy and the proper educational tools and so on. You know, those children, I've worked with Down syndrome children. I know what they can do. You know, years ago, those children were automatically dropped into institutions. And, you know, I've done the therapy with them, the physical therapy. I've taught them certain things. And one of my favorite projects was working with children, teenage kids with Down syndrome, and teaching them how to get on a bus, pay the money, and then wait for them to get off the bus at the next stop. And I tell you, my nerves. You know, waiting for these kids to get off the bus. And, oh, please, God, let them get off the bus at the right place. Of course, we had someone planted on the bus. But nonetheless, it's like it's your child, and you can't wait for that kid to get off the bus. And it's a very proud moment when they're able to do that. So they can, many of them can have jobs and can do well on their own. Some of them cannot. And you have to know what the limitations are. And so if you work with these people, explain to them how the system works. They're afraid. I had one woman say to me, well, I'm really afraid about the home study. And I said, listen, home study is a piece of cake. I said, I've had a full field FBI investigation for all my different jobs. I said, by the time I did that, I filed for a mortgage. And then I had my home study as a single person. You can imagine what a home study is for a single person. You know, you feel like you're standing naked on Pennsylvania Avenue. You have nothing left. And I said, listen, you know, if you're married, it's a piece of cake. I mean, the home study is tough, and it's supposed to be tough, and it's to protect the children. And to protect the people to make sure they're not getting into a situation they can't handle. But, you know, and once you talk to them, we found that if we have adoption fairs and we have a caseworker there who can answer questions and talk about these kids, and we have pictures of children up on the board. And last year, a year ago, we had a picture of a little girl with Down syndrome, a baby, and her name was Sarah. And as I was telling some of you, my son, New Year's Day this year, said, Mom, do you think baby Sarah is still available for adoption? And I said, what are you talking about? And suddenly it dawned on me, I remembered who baby Sarah was. And he said, you know, she's a special kid. She needs special kind of love, and we can give it to her, and I think we should adopt baby Sarah. Yeah. And he said, you know, we'll start out with one more, and maybe, you know. Wait. So the next day I got him a dog. And eventually we will go back and we will get some more kids. You know, when that's seen out, we will go back and get some more. But after the test, we're still to go. But it does work. Adoption fairs do work. And if you do a buddy system, which is what we've done in our agency, a buddy system with adoptive parents who've been through it, these people can call up in the middle of the night and say, oh my God, you know, I can't tell you the number of calls I've had, you know, from people I don't even know. Had one lady from New Jersey, oh, you know, I want to adopt, but I don't know if it's the right thing. If I adopt an older child, you know, will that child not like me initially? And, you know, all the emotional things you worry about, because this is a very personal, emotional situation. So I said, oh, it's wonderful. You know, come meet my kids. You know, get to know my kids, relax, play with them a little bit, you know, that kind of thing. So she did. She and her husband came down and played with my kids, spent a lot of time with them, decided to do it. They wound up adopting four little girls. And the little girls had been through a very tough time. You know, she called me up, and, you know, they had different fathers, same mother, but different fathers. And they were all over the place, you know, in different foster care homes from one to another. They'd been bounced all over the place. So she had a lot to contend with, from going from no kids to four little girls all at once. She called me up in the middle of the night, oh my God, now what am I going to do? They're here in a wreck, you know? So for about 2 weeks, I had calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. She would always wait till 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know why that was. But anyway. And, you know, if you have a buddy system, it works. You know, because you've been through it, you know, the emotional adjustments that need to be made. So we have the buddy system. We have the information available. We sort of help them along the process. And it really does work. It's very successful. So, anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much for letting me bend your ear.
anything else that I think